Today, I'd just like to give you a bit of a really brief overview on the Psalms as a whole, as we're starting to engage them in the reading plan. I know that we read the first book of the five book of the Psalms already, back with Ruth, but now we're reading a huge chunk if you're following in the Bible reading plan right now. So I'd just like to give you a really high-level overview of the Psalms. And then we'll focus in on this character of Asaph and the content of his or their Psalms. So Psalms holds a lot of records in the Bible. It's got the longest chapter. Anyone know what that is? Okay, it's got the shortest chapter. Anyone know what that is? 117. I know, you didn't come up to it in your reading. Otherwise, you would have surely immediately recognized, hey, that's way too short. Bless you. And so it's also the largest book we have in the Bible. It has the unique identifier as having the most authors in it. It's got the longest period of composition. It covers the longest period, as far as I can tell. The content of the Psalms covers right around 1,000 years, at least 700 years. The actual composition certainly appears to be about 1,000 years. And what I mean by composition is, you'll notice as you read the Psalms, it is definitely not chronological. Okay, some of the Bible is, some of the Bible isn't. And we've already encountered that, and that's not a problem. These Psalms were collected and compiled over different periods, very likely, and sometimes hundreds of years apart, and brought together as these cohesive books. And so as you read through the Psalms, if you haven't recognized it before, maybe you will this time, you come across these headings: book 1, book 2, book 3, book 4, book 5. Some people recognize in that composition a connection to the Pentateuch, which also has five books. And you can draw some type of strands there between the content of those Psalms and the Pentateuch, the general story there. I think you can see that there, but it's not explicit. It's not over the top, that connection between the Pentateuch. But you certainly can see some of that thematically. When I try to make sense of the content of the Psalms and how they're composed, I will say it's not random. We see a lot of Psalms that are very tightly connected, close together. And the compilers who put these together are very clearly okay with taking Psalms out from one spot and into another, and for the purpose of kind of following some content and theme. And so while in chapter 72 this week, if you're following along, you saw that little scribal addition that the Psalms of David are ended. Interestingly, that comes after Solomon's Psalm, which is Psalm 72. But it says the Psalms of David are ended. Of course, for us, as we read that, they're not ended. We'll see Davidic Psalms in other books forward. And so they're compiled and composed, it seems, to express something uniquely in each book. And the best argument I've seen and the best way I can track the overall movement, and each Psalms, each book has a piece of lament and praise, a feeling of exile, feeling of an exalted monarchy. All of them carry a bit of that, but you see different content kind of emphasized in the groupings. And so I think the best overall track is recognizing that the first book or two of the Psalms track roughly with the feelings of the monarchy, even amid its struggles, the feelings of a monarchy, whether united or divided, but still there's a clear sense of hope. But when you turn to book 3, from Psalm 72 to Psalm 73, there's really an amazing amazing turn. You have Psalm 72, which is kind of the most glorifying, lifted up psalm, putting the king way up there and acknowledging his place and God's hold on him. And then you go to Psalm 73, and it's a totally different feel. It's like almost everything has been lost. You get a very Job-like psalm. In Psalm 73, the first half of it, the psalmist, who's Asaph, is expressing this sense of lostness. It's like, where are you, God? And where's justice? And why do the unjust prevail? And why are they doing so well? And he's struggling halfway through that psalm. But the rest of the psalms in book three, it's probably, in my view, okay, it's the most concise thematically. If you read through the whole third book of the Psalms, 73 to 89, you get a very unified picture of desperation, of lostness, that speaks to exile. Okay, so that's high level. A couple other interesting things about the Psalms. Roughly one third, okay, so by far the biggest chunk, roughly one third of the 360 Old Testament quotations and allusions that we find in the New Testament, okay? So the New Testament writers looking back on the Old Testament and bringing it in to make their case, right? There's roughly 360 of those quotes and allusions, and about one third of them are from the Psalms. So that's a lot of content from the Psalms that's being drawn upon, okay? And about two-thirds of the Psalms, so there's 150 Psalms, just shy of 100 Psalms are pretty directly linked in the New Testament. So there's some reference to two-thirds of the Psalms. So a ton of the content of the Psalms, which I know we wrestle with when we read, just be aware that the New Testament writers are constantly leveraging the theology that's given to us there. So it's a very, very important book, even though it's often enough, I think, neglected in worship and certainly in preaching. And part of it is because it's tough to preach. I mean, last night I was thinking about just like mailing it in. Just like, this is too hard. I can't even see connections. And fortunately, the Lord started putting the patchwork together. But it's difficult. And I think part of that is the Psalms are built to be meditated on and chewed over and taken slowly. So when you're taking it in bigger chunks, it doesn't quite fit the mold that well of the literature and the design for it. That said, I'd like to spend a little time in more than just one psalm. So I'm just going to pull together some recognizable threads that I saw and that other readers saw, who I read, saw connecting these psalms of Asaph. So first, who is this guy? Asaph. So there are at least four Asaphs in the Bible, but the one who's prominent is presumably this Asaph, this writer of several psalms. And there are 12 attributed to Asaph in the bulletin here. There's reference to the 11, because those are the 11 that show up in book 3. But there's also one back in book 2, Psalm 50. Okay, so there's 12 psalms of Asaph. And Asaph is recognized as the son of Berechiah. I'll give you one description. Well, first let's look at the biblical. This is one of the texts that recognizes David's appointing Asaph. Okay, so Asaph is someone with musical ability. He's someone who apparently is pretty good on the cymbals. That's the thing that's particularly recognized with him. And I don't know how you feel about the cymbals, but Asaph was pretty good with them. And he's recognized in different points as one of the singers, but also as a prominent singer and leader. In one place, he's even called a chief. And so he's one of the three main people that are instituted, so by David. So David, remember, he's the one that's trying to centralize worship. He's the one that desires to build the temple. He wants everybody in the same place. He doesn't quite get that privilege, but he prepares everything he can. And part of that is preparing and bringing and ordaining, in a way, these ministers who will be singers. And all throughout, beginning at this point, the singers are very well taken care of. They're part of the Levitical tradition that the people are obligated to make sure can do their job. So they're funded. So, you know, I don't know how you feel about funded music directors, and it's certainly nice to have these amazing volunteers we've had over the years, but there's certainly some Old Testament justification we can see for people who are fully invested, have the gifts of music, and are recognized by the church. So anyway, 1 Chronicles 25, 1-2. David and the chiefs of the service also set apart for the service the sons of Asaph. Okay, so not just Asaph, but his kind of tribal unit. So it forms a bit of a guild. And of Heman and of Jeduthun, who prophesied with lyres. Interesting word there, prophesied. With harps and with cymbals. The list of those who did the work and of their duties was of the sons of Asaph, Zachar, Joseph, Nethaniah, and Asharela, sons of Asaph, under the direction of Asaph. So his name keeps coming back up, right? Even among these three, who prophesied under the direction of the king. Now we might think maybe that's kind of a weird translation there, prophesied. These guys are just singers. But in a different place, Asaph is recognized as a seer, and some of the other musicians. So there's some prophetical overlap in this office. So the people who are bringing others together to worship hold an incredibly important office, which cannot be diminished or should not be diminished by the church. And interestingly, Asaph's name, anybody know what it is? I bet you already, you don't know? Well, that's a first. All right, so Asaph's name, it's the verb behind the name means to gather or collect. And so what an appropriate name for this worship leader, one who gathers, collects. It's got connotations with harvesting. So you're bringing in the people. So that's a bit about Asaph. He's a big deal. David brought him in at the time of centralized worship when the ark was coming in, okay? And he's still around when the temple's built and then when the ark comes into the temple. And so he's part of that piece. So I'd just like to give a little bit of color from the scripture on that experience of when the ark came into the temple. The priests were actually in the temple, as far as my reading is able to grasp here. The priests begin in the temple. The ark was brought in into the most holy place. And then the priests were sent out. And you find out for good reason why they didn't stay in there. So this from, yeah, here it is. This from 2 Chronicles chapter 5, verses 12 to 14. So this is right after the priest is brought in, or the ark is brought in. And all the Levitical singers, Asaph, Heman, and Jeduthun, their sons and kinsmen, arrayed in fine linen with cymbals, harps, lyres, stood east of the altar with 120 priests who were trumpeters. So this is a lot of people involved in worship. How important is worship to our God? We should begin to get a grasp of that as we read these texts. 120 priests who were trumpeters. And it was the duty of the trumpeters and singers to make themselves heard. That's what a musician wants to hear there. Their job is to be heard. To make themselves heard in unison in praise and thanksgiving to the Lord. And when the song was raised with trumpets and cymbals and other musical instruments, in praise to the Lord. For he is good, for his steadfast love endures forever. All in unison, trumpets, cymbals, all this instrumentation. So this was a big deal. covenant ceremonies, other times when the music is kind of at its full. You know, we probably think about Christmas and Easter as certain times when we have those unique musical performances. Well, when the ark was brought in, it was tremendous, and Asaph was right there, front row seat. So they sang, "For he is good, for his steadfast love endures forever." The house, it says, the house of the Lord was filled with a cloud, so that the priests could not stand to minister because of the cloud. So it says house twice and cloud twice, really making sure we pick up on how important this is. For the glory of the Lord filled the house of God. And Asaph, as important as he was, in his train, the sons of Asaph continued to be extremely important to temple worship all the way through the kingdom. There's reference to Asaph and the sons of Asaph all the way up to Hezekiah, Josiah, Jehoshaphat. Those weren't in order. But towards the end of the kingdom, they're still prominent. And even when Ezra and Nehemiah, right, those are the guys who brought everyone back out of exile, out of captivity in Babylon, when they came out, even though they had somewhat slim resources and it was tough getting the work done, as we talked about before, one of the first things they did was institute temple worship and made sure again that the temple workers were paid, that they were singing, that they were taken care of, because this worship was so important. And there's a bunch of things that were still broken down, things that needed to be repaired. I mean, shouldn't we take care of the basics first? Well, for the people of God, the basics are worship of God. And so it's extremely valuable, especially for you who are leading us in music. I don't know what you feel about that craft, that responsibility. It's an amazing, amazing privilege and a weight. And so do it with joy and do it with the burden that's intended, because that's the most basic thing we do here. You know, before we have the mission to our neighbors and all of that, it's the worship of our God. And so in Ezra and Nehemiah's time, again, it was really made sure that worship was tightened up, even while other things might have been left lagging. And so the sons of Asaph were directly involved with the dedication of the second temple as well. But listen to the difference when you read Ezra chapter 3, verses 10 to 13. Again, you have this guild of Asaph. It's been around for over 400 years now, still prominent. But at the dedication of the second temple, something's off. Now, when the builders had laid the foundation of the temple of the Lord, the priests stood in their apparel with trumpets, and the Levites, the sons of Asaph, with cymbals, to praise the Lord according to the direction of King David of Israel. Or the directions. King David's not there. They sang, praising and giving thanks to the Lord. Okay, this sounds the same. Saying, "For he is good, for his loving kindness is upon Israel forever." And all the people shouted with a great shout when they praised the Lord, because the foundation of the house of the Lord was laid. Yet many of the priests and Levites, maybe some of the sons of Asaph, heads of fathers' households, the old men who had seen the first temple, wept with a loud voice when the foundation of this house was laid before their eyes, while many shouted aloud for joy, so that the people could not distinguish the sound of the shout of joy from the sound of the weeping of the people. For the people shouted with a loud shout, and the sound was heard from far away. And so you have this mingling of praise worship, but also pain-filled worship. And that's kind of a perfect connection to where we are in the Psalms of Asaph, because that's exactly what you have. You have the expression of someone in pain who feels neglected, who feels like the justice of God has gone somewhere else who feels like, I don't know when this thing's coming back together, and yet, intermixed with that pain is true praise of God, is true trust in God, is a true sense that somehow, I might not see it in my day, but somehow God will make things right. And so that's a prominent idea carried in the Psalms of Asaph, especially Psalms 73 to 83. A quick thing on authorship here, because authorship in the Psalms is kind of, is a bit of a tricky thing, which I don't know if you're familiar with it or not. So about how many of the Psalms do we know are attributed to David? About how many? Anybody? Let me throw out some options. A quarter, a half, 75%? What do you think? I know, I need to have some type of survey component built into this. So you said a quarter. It's actually a half. Yeah, 73 are tied to him by name. So we'll say a Psalm of David or something like that. And two other psalms are connected to David via the New Testament. And so at least half, this is often why the Psalms are called the treasury of David. At least half of this book is attributed to him. But there are other authors attributed here. But it's not always clear what the identifiers mean, okay? So one thing on suggesting that Asaph, that person who we're talking about, who was prominent, who we should, it should not surprise us that this person of prominence would create Psalms, or someone in his household. We have Hezekiah making reference specifically to David and Asaph and their Psalms. So, Hezekiah says here, "Moreover, King Hezekiah and the officials ordered the Levites to sing praises to the Lord with the words of David and Asaph, the seer." Interesting, he's called the seer again there. "So they sang praises with joy and bowed down and worshiped." But there also seems to be some evidence of sort of family worship. Some of the other psalms, they have the moniker, the sons of Korah, right? And so there's a plural there. The Asaph ones always referred to just Asaph. And so we might think, you know, we're really obligated, no matter what comes, to believe that Asaph had to have written all of these. One of the struggles with that is the things he describes. So remember, he's at the beginning of the kingdom with David. But some of the things he describes are at the very end and beyond the end. He describes a situation that can only be described as exile and captivity, which is part of the potency of his book, Book 3, and part of its location there. And so there's kind of two ways to resolve that. One is to say, well, first, if you haven't had the chance to read these, I'll just read the references, because they speak of the temple, A. B, they speak of the temple being destroyed, which didn't happen until the end of the kingdom. So that's 400 years later. They set sanctuary on fire. They profaned the dwelling place of your name, bringing it down to the ground. And then in Psalm 79, "O God, the nations have come into your inheritance. They have defiled your holy temple. They have laid Jerusalem in ruins." And so even with the trouble David had with Absalom, that Asaph is describing something he did not see. So there's a few ways to make sense of that. One is to say, okay, well, he was a seer. And the word does say he prophesied. When I read these psalms, they don't seem to me to indicate prophecy. They don't seem to be written in a way to suggest. That's how they're written. So, and that's not just because they're past tense. Often prophets will speak in past tense because for them, with the vision they see, it's as good as done when God says something's going to happen. But the whole sense that's carried by these psalms doesn't seem to have carry that. So the other way to make sense of it is to take a look at the designation itself. When you look at a psalm that says a psalm of, okay, That's how we see it in the English, right? Psalm of David, Psalm of Asaph. And the Greek matches that pretty closely, okay? You can almost read the letters here, Greek's left to right, just like English. And so you have psalmos, okay? It's been a while since I've done my Greek, but to Asaph. Yeah, pretty straightforward. I'll get into it in a second. So you see it kind of matching up. You can even tell, the next slide will explain it. I'll try not to get ahead of myself. The Hebrew, remember, you read right to left, okay? So what you see in the Hebrew is mizmor, which is the word for psalm or melody. So that's why a lot of people will talk about the Psalms as a hymn book. Okay, mizmor or melody. And then that little question mark looking thing, it stands by itself. It's a preposition. It's a prepositional connection, okay? Le. And then Asaph, okay? So you have a similar construct with each one. But when you look at the, I know this is a bit geeky, so we'll be right back to normal in a second. But just to look at the different connections, the English clearly expresses a connection of source, of, like a psalm of or from, okay? But it's more ambiguous. Sometimes the Greek and Hebrew clear things up and the English is very ambiguous. I try to help you with those points. Sometimes it's the other way around and we want to box it in really nicely and the language doesn't want to make it that easy on us. So first, with the Greek, the case that's represented, so you can put words in different cases, the case that's representative is the dative case, which is a case you would use to express a 2-4 relationship. So say it's a psalm of David, right? It's a psalm to or for David, which could suggest it's concerning or about David. You know, this is a psalm that speaks to a certain point of his life. It's a psalm to or for him, okay? If you wanted to say a psalm sourced in, if you wanted to say that with no ambiguity, you would use the genitive case, which is the case of possession, okay? And if that was there, it would just be easy as day in terms of English translation. Yeah, psalm of David, psalm of Asaph, gotcha. But instead, this other case is used, suggests a little more ambiguity, 2-4. And the Hebrew is the same. So the le preposition, it can be, again, to, for, concerning, about. And yes, so idiomatically, it can speak of authorship. And so it's a bit ambiguous. It's a bit ambiguous. And I don't think it's an expression of a lack of faith to look at the Psalms of Asaph and go, it looks like there's more here than one person's experience expresses. Again, it could be prophetic here, but I don't see most people connecting his writings to those type of prophecies. And so most will say the connection here of the Psalm of Asaph, it is speaking of authorship, but Asaph is used as kind of a cover for sons of Asaph, similar to sons of Korah. So I think that's a potential. I'll leave it up to you. Either way, this is not a deal breaker for me, because the content of the Psalms is really what drives everything. And these titles are not the most important thing, but they do give a little bit of color for us. And so I just want to talk to you about a few things that I see connecting these Psalms. One is, and all of these, mind you, point to the expression of captivity and the expression of one in exile, which is part of how the books of Psalms flows. And so I think the book 3 is really the best clear expression of captivity and exile. And so, unsurprisingly, you have language about Egypt. We've talked about Egypt a lot because it's a big part of Israel's story. How often have we heard when we've read, I am the God who, yeah, brought you out of Egypt, out of slavery. I'm the God who brought you out. And we might expect the reference of Egypt to be, I expected to see it a lot more in the Psalms. It's actually the word Egypt itself, okay? The reference to the Exodus is plenty in the Psalms, much more than the reference of the word Egypt, okay? So psalmist looking back and making reference to Egypt, there's a lot of it throughout the Psalms. But in terms of physically referencing Egypt, saying that word, it only shows up 15 times. It doesn't show up that prominently. And interestingly, the first time it shows up in relation to the Exodus is by guess who? Asaph. So the first time Egypt is the name Egypt is evoked. The first psalmist to do that is Asaph. And again, I think that's because he's expressing somehow the condition of captivity and exile. And so you have these references here. Just to be full disclosure here, there's one reference prior to this. That's what I'm looking for right now. I think it's chapter 68. Psalm 68. That's unimportant. I'm just trying to give you the full heads up here. Wow, we don't have that much left. Isn't that good news? Happy Mother's Day. There's not much left. Now, I know you guys don't think that way. You're very holy. You want to stay here all day. So I'll do my best. So Psalm 68 is the first reference to Egypt, but that's Psalm 68:31. It's actually a picture of the expanding monarchy and its expanding influence. And so it's a picture of Egypt and Cush and these other nations coming. So that's a description of a different time. But when Asaph brings Egypt into mind, he is talking about that condition of felt slavery. Now, why would someone who's kind of harping on captivity and exile think about Egypt? I mean, it's pretty obvious, right? So I'll leave that one as rhetorical. Because there were slaves in Egypt for hundreds of years. That was a long time waiting. And sometimes when we are waiting and we're in suffering and we're waiting for God's answer, it's a long time coming. It's a long time. And so the Bible continually tells us, look back. I'm the God who called you out of Egypt. And for the Christian, I'm the God who called you out of sin and death. The great Exodus. And so Asaph will bring in these references. You can read them if you want there, but it's just to illustrate the fact that he is leveraging this feeling of slavery and desire to have that Exodus experience of coming back out, of seeing the Lord's blessing in his day. And in keeping with that, you have many references to how long in this section. These are peppered throughout the Psalms, but it's really prominent in this section in book 3. And so just a few of these references, and there's more within each Psalm here, but this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to give you these three references, Psalm 74, 79, 77. And then we're going to think about how do you deal with that? How do you deal well with that? With being in an exilic condition, with being in a captive condition, with awaiting the Lord's answer. Mitch, right? I mean, waiting the Lord's answer. I mean, where is that provision going to come? You're looking under every rock and you're just waiting, right? And so the expression here, how long, it finds its match in each of these Psalms. I'll show you a matching solution. It might be a solution that surprises you, kind of like Job. It's like, is that really a fix, God? Yes. So how long? Oh God, why do you cast us off forever? Why does your anger smoke against the sheep of your pasture? And then in 79, how long, O Lord, will you be angry forever? Will you Will your jealousy burn like fire? Psalm 77. Will the Lord spurn forever and never again be favorable? And this is how it feels when we're in a dark place and when we're waiting the Lord's answer. It feels like the answer will never come. Like we'll never see the answer to prayer. And it's okay to express prayer in that way. It's okay to cry out. That's actually part of the solution of the Psalms. Maybe more than half of the solution. It's at least half. You're in a dire state. You're in a place of need. You're in a place of suffering. You're in a place of shrinking hope, shrinking faith. Step one, say it to the Lord. Cry out. It was not Job's loud cries that offended the Lord or that put him over the line. It was the content of what he was saying and some of the assumptions he started making about the Lord's judgments. But it's no offense to be in a place of suffering and to cry out. And if it was, then we know that Jesus made a mistake when he was in the Garden of Gethsemane, crying out, saying, if there's any other way. And so part of the solution is just expressing the frustration of our human condition. How long? How long? But it's not the only part. And what misery if that's it, if that's our only solution, just crying out. We just become lifelong mourners, lifelong complainers and grumblers. We become those who have no hope. And it's not the only part of the solution. In these same Psalms, there's something else to do when you're waiting and when you're suffering and when you're wailing. And that's to worship. And that seems like the totally opposite thing a suffering person would do. Who wants to sing when they're suffering? Who wants to praise when they are bathed in pain? Who wants to do that? But it will be healing. It will be healing. Hopefully by now you know it by experience. You don't want to praise God. I don't want to be here this Sunday. I don't want to talk about that. I don't want to hear that Bible verse. But as you step forward in that worship that you resist and the healing that comes with it, you break through that and you worship anyway and you trust God anyway and you remember what he's done before and all of a sudden, healing that doesn't seem to belong there is coming. And all of a sudden, peace that does not accord with your circumstance is upon you. All of a sudden, your mourning turns to joy, and you're dancing at a time you shouldn't be. And so the psalmists, they cry out. They do cry out. But then they turn and worship. Because what a misery if all you have to do is cry. But you also remember the character of the one you cry to. His character, his power, his glory, his dominion, his coming kingdom, his resurrection, and your hope in him. And so in the midst of those cries, they might just be these very small peppered praises, very small. You might be crying, 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 but then turn to praise. Find a way. Yet, God, my King, is from of old, working salvation in the midst of the earth. And all around this is cries in the psalm. Psalm 79, the whole thing is an expression of misery. The only thing that even evokes any amount of trust is the very last verse. But we, your people, the sheep of your pasture, will give thanks to you forever. From generation to generation, we will recount your praise. In Psalm 77, then I said, I will appeal to this, to the years of the right hand of the Most High. But I'd like to read you Psalm 77. because that one-off verse doesn't get the sense of it. And so I want us to follow the psalmist's approach here, because there is no withholding of a cry of despair. You know, the psalmists were willing to express doubt and confusion and all that. But when we take a break, which you see right in the middle of this psalm, in verse 9, there's a Selah. And no one really knows what it means, but it seems to be a pause more than anything in my readings. Certainly seems appropriate here. There's crying, 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 and then Selah. And there seems to be just a break and a pause. And somehow, there is a turn to worship, and the perspective changes. It's kind of like, I'll do the goofy thing now so that we can be serious when I read the psalm. But it's kind of like, and sorry to reference an R-rated movie that I watched before I was a pastor, but The Matrix. The Matrix, one of the big cinematic things about The Matrix, I don't know if you remember, the green screen stuff was really taking off, but also, I don't know what it's called. I wish I had Carl here. But there was this effect that was created by having just dozens of cameras circularly placed around the object, and then you'd have the green screens in the background so you could make that look like whatever. But the cameras would enable you to have one view of a thing and then to be able to pause and reframe and see it from a different angle. And so I'm just going to do it and embarrass myself. You have the Matrix moment when Neo is shot at, and he kind of surprises himself and everybody watching, and it's just, poof. You remember this? Anybody? Am I just swimming backwards here? Poof. Right? And bullets are flying over. But in the process of that, the angle is changing. There's a pause, and it's doo-doo-doo-doo-doo, and it's like you're entering a different plane and seeing things from a whole different perspective. It's just like, whoa, the NFL does that sometimes now, mid-play. He's throwing this way, then the camera tilts, doo-doo-doo, so you can see down the field this way. And this is what happens when we turn from our cry to our praise. We get a whole different perspective. It's like we enter the spiritual plane, and it doesn't mean we make sense of everything. We just see the most important thing. When we're crying out, we're looking right there at the circumstance. We're looking right at the pain. But when we turn to praise, we're looking right at God. It's a whole nother plane. It's a whole nother view. And it's real. We're not emotionally manipulating ourselves. We're not like cheating ourselves out of the mourning. We're not skipping that process. The pain's real. The suffering's real. But we're getting a deeper, higher, wider, more amazing view of the situation. And it might not allow us to kind of assemble things to make sense of it, but it allows us to see God and to come back down to earth trusting and face the suffering. This is what you see in Psalm 77. So I'll let this be our close. Entitled in my Bible, "In the Day of Trouble I Seek the Lord," to the choir master, according to Jeduthun, a psalm of Asaph. "I cry aloud to God, and he will hear me. In the day of my trouble I seek the Lord. In the night my hand is stretched out with wearying. My soul refuses to be comforted. When I remember God, I moan. When I meditate, my spirit faints. You hold my eyelids open. I am so troubled that I cannot speak. I consider the days of old, the years long ago. I said, let me remember my song in the night. Let me meditate in my heart. Then my spirit made a diligent search. Will the Lord spurn forever and never again be favorable? Has his steadfast love forever ceased? Are his promises at an end for all time? Has God forgotten to be gracious? Has he in anger shut up his compassion? Selah." Then I said, I will appeal to this, to the years of the right hand of the Most High. I will remember the deeds of the Lord. Yes, I will remember your wonders of old. I will ponder all your work and meditate on your mighty deeds. Your way, O God, is holy. What God is great like our God? You are the God who works wonders. You have made known your might among the peoples. You with your arm redeemed your people, the children of Jacob and Joseph. Selah. When the waters saw you, O God, when the waters saw you, they were afraid. Indeed, the deep trembled. The clouds poured out water. The skies gave forth thunder. Your arrows flashed on every side. The crash of your thunder was in the whirlwind. Your lightnings lighted up the world. The earth trembled and shook. Your way was through the sea. Not around the sea, not around the suffering, not around the circumstance, not around the pain. Your way was through the sea, your path through the great waters, yet your footprints were unseen. Maybe that's why we so quickly forget. You led your people like a flock by the hand of Moses and Aaron. And he will lead you. You cry to him in your need, in your desperation, and turn and praise him. And he will. He will carry you through, though you do not see his footprints. Amen.